This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Did you ever think the perkiness of Gidget and Patty Duke were actually assertiveness masquerading as cuteness? It's something Susan Douglas considers in her new book, Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media. She grew up watching fairy tale princesses, beach bunnies, witches, flying nuns, bionic women, beauty queens, and mothers who cleaned the house in spotless dresses. Douglas thinks TV, movies, and records gave girls lots of mixed messages, but they helped make her a feminist. She describes her new book as a tour through the images of the past four decades in which she reviews and makes fun of the media-induced schizophrenia so many women feel. She has a love-hate relationship with some TV shows, like Charlie's Angels, which premiered in the wake of the women's movement.
I remember two things about Charlie's Angels back in 1976. One is that I, like many other feminists, deplored the wet t-shirts, the hip huggers, the string bikinis, and the fact that Charlie's voice came out through the boombox to tell them what to do.
Can I just stop you and mention the hairdos? Okay.
Oh, the hairdos, yes. And there was a lot of writing up about how long it took to get the hair just perfect, right? We're talking like 3 hours with the hairdressers to get the perfectly flouncy, bouncy look that the angels had. Okay, so yeah, there was a lot that was retrograde about the show. The other thing I remember about it is I watched it every Wednesday night, and so did millions of American women. And so when I wanted to explore this contradiction as I went back to write about it for the book. And what I found that I have to confess, completely forgotten is that once Charlie's voice is off of the boombox and they are out of the office and away from Dumbo Bosley, what's going on here is that there are three women working together. They actually use on screen deductive and inductive reasoning to figure out who the bad guy is and why he is behaving the way he is. They refer to many of these bad guys as male chauvinist pigs, and they use their guns to rescue themselves and each other. So you see a lot of very powerful feminist moments in a show that is wrapped up in the most anti-feminist packaging.
I guess I'm too cynical to see those things as feminist moments. I'm so cynical I see it as some scriptwriter thinking, yeah, and we'll throw in a couple of male chauvinist pigs and words like that, and, you know, maybe that'll help us in the ratings.
Oh,
or maybe it'll help us pose as a feminist show.
Oh, well, you know, I think one always has to separate out intention from result. And the intentions may have been as cynical as you've just described them, absolutely. I mean, you know, these guys were no fools. They were going after the young female market, and they knew that the women's movement had made a difference for these young women in terms of how they viewed the world. On the other hand, it was clear that most of us were not going to give up nice clothes and, you know, nice hair. We'd just been socialized too long that way. But I think that you have to separate out the intention of the producers, which may have indeed been quite cynical, from the way the show was regarded. And to see for an hour on television three women, string bikinis or not, working together, often to help some other woman who was usually of a lower class than they, save her sister or, you know, get some information or save her job or whatever, was as strangulated and constricted as it was uplifting for some of us. I mean, there are very few shows still on television today where there are three women working together to get the bad guys, and they did it.
One of the things you did for your book was to go back and look at the early news coverage of the women's movement. What are some of the things that struck you going back?
Well, the kinds of things that got said on television back then by male commentators would hopefully get them fired today. Ms. Magazine was dismissed when it came out by Harry Reasoner as kind of tabloid trash. In editorials on the nightly news, it was speculated that if the Equal Rights Amendment really passed, that this would solve once and for all the question about whether the United States would be the policeman of the world, since half the regiment, the female half, could never be ready on time to get any place. I mean, these were the kinds of things, they were part and parcel of the news coverage of the period. There was an enormous amount of ridicule and condescension about the women's movement. But the other thing that happened in the news coverage was that there were sympathetic moments. There were opportunities for feminists to have platforms from which they could address millions of women who barely knew a feminist movement was starting. And so, again, the media coverage was a real double-edged sword. On the one hand, it really constricted what was possible through feminism. On the other hand, it brought to the attention of millions of men and women in the country the fact that there was a women's movement, that women's private concerns were not personal or individualized, they were part of larger societal problems, and that there was a movement out to change that. So I think that the media coverage of the women's movement, while primarily retrograde in the extreme, also had some very important positive political effects.
You think that the news media today are schizophrenic about feminism?
Yes, I do. I think that the legacy from the coverage of the 1970s still lives with us today. If you say you're a feminist, you get the whole stereotype that goes with that, which means that you are an anti-fashion, child-hating, man-hating, makeup-loathing, humorless, strident harridan from hell. And, you know, this stereotype is incredibly resilient and has been over the years. So to identify yourself as a feminist carries, you know, baggage with it that who wants to take that on?
Do you have any idea how the image of feminism became this stereotype that you just described?
Yeah. There was a great deal of institutional sexism in the news media, and you had male editors telling reporters to go out and find experts who would denounce the women's movement as, and I use paraphrase their terms, you know, a load of crap. And so they would find various sociologists who would say that feminists were maladjusted, that they hated men, that what they were really trying to do was compensate for the fact that they were terribly unattractive. These sorts of things got printed in sidebars in national magazines that sought to document the various ways in which feminists were, misguided. The other most popular illustration for any story about feminism was a woman doing black belt karate, especially if she was performing it on a man. And again, there were male editors who were reported as saying at the time, go get pictures of bra burning and karate. And the karate chopping image was prevalent. So then there were caricatures that were drawn of feminists. There was a very famous one that appeared in Esquire, and Esquire used to have images of these beautiful peach-toned nudes with a little poem, you know, about they were January's girl or something. And what they printed in the January 1971 issue was a parody of the pinup, and it was a feminist. And she had, you know, Roman centurion sandals on and baggy watermelon breasts and a look that could, you know, basically blast the testicles off of any man. And she was fearsome. And this was the feminist. Then this image got reproduced elsewhere, including in Time magazine. So I do have to point to the news media as playing a very important role in perpetuating this particular stereotype of a feminist.
My guest is Susan Douglas. She's the author of the new book, Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about growing up female with the mass media. My guest is Susan Douglas. A lot of the old shows that you write about in your new book, shows from the 50s and 60s, are back on the air again, mostly on cable television. So a lot of the stereotypical images of women are, you know, back on TV again. And some people watch it for nostalgia, and other people are seeing it for the first time around. I wonder if you think that, say, the Donna Reed image has a different impact now, when people see it as reruns in the 90s, than when it played the first time around.
Well, I think that the more that what is particularly interesting now is, and this has been going on, especially on Nickelodeon, is the revival of Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. And what's interesting about these is these shows have been two of the longest, most widely syndicated shows on all kinds of stations throughout the country. So people know these shows, and yet now Nickelodeon is making a splash by re-airing the early seasons of Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie, I think to great fanfare and great success. And these shows, the way in which they speak to a combination of the traditional woman at home who wants to please her husband, and yet who just can't quite stick to it because she has these magical powers and because she wants to break out of the home. I think that tension still speaks to people today. Granted, in an incredibly kitschy, you know, silly sort of way, but the metaphorical acting out of this tension, and people can inoculate themselves by laughing at it, but there it is. And I think that tension still speaks to people quite a bit.
Okay, well, let's go deeper into Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. What's the different ways that Jeannie and Samantha use their witchy powers?
Well, Samantha aired first. The Bewitched was premiered in 1964, and it was a blockbuster for ABC. It was a huge hit, and second only to the Western of Westerns, Bonanza. And when this show aired, it showed a domestic housewife, a young housewife, trying to do all of the traditional things that a young housewife would do. But at the same time, of course, she had this problem. She was a witch. Now, what we see in the early episodes of this show is that Samantha uses her witchcraft to expose corrupt politicians, to help her husband's ad campaigns, to fly to Paris with her mother for lunch, to instruct a dress designer on how to design real clothes for real American women instead of models. So there are a host of ways in which Samantha uses her magical power to intervene in the world and to have some agency in the world. And she's very much set up as an extremely sensible, smart person, much smarter and more inventive than her dumbo husband, Darren.
What about Jeannie?
Now, Jeannie is a different story. Jeannie is a warning. Jeannie is almost a backlash to Bewitched. Jeannie shows what happens when women get power, and it's a warning. Even the manned space program is no match for a woman with too much power. And she is a kind of femininity run amok. She uses her power primarily in a very petulant way to get back at Major Nelson if she's feeling possessive or jealous or neglected. She's often angry with him because he's not devoting enough time to her and too much time is to his job. And so there's not the same kind of intervention in the world. Of course, all you'd have to do is take one look at the two of them and see the little harem outfit with the, you know, pom-poms dangling off of it to know that Jeannie and Samantha are two very different kinds of witches with magic power.
What shows on television now say the most to you about how women are seen and portrayed in the mass media?
I think that, well, I tend to look at what shows are most popular in part because I want to see what most people are watching. I think that Roseanne and Murphy Brown have been very important shows for a variety of reasons, but they've given platforms to mouthy women, and that's been key. On the other hand, I think a real zeitgeist show right now is Melrose Place, which has had such enormous popularity. And I think the reason it's hit such a nerve is that, like soap operas before it, whether they were Dallas or Dynasty, it navigates that turbulent water between feminism and anti-feminism. It's got real bad villainesses. It's got good girls. It deals with feminist issues on the one hand, and yet shows that sometimes when women get power, it's bad. And it's really smack dab in the middle of that brew in which feminism and anti-feminism roil together, and viewers pull out of it what they can as they're kind of cobbling together their own responses to how to be in the world.
Okay, well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Susan Douglas is the author of Where the Girls Are. She's a professor of media and American studies at Hampshire College. This is Fresh Air.